Anyone? We're talking about love. We are, in fact, looking at a love song this morning, or something like a love song. We're in a portion of God's Word, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where an early church leader named Paul, he stops right in the middle of addressing a bunch of drama that Christians are having, and I know that's really hard to believe. And he picks up his guitar, he checks the mic, he clears his throat. Aquila and Priscilla, they begin to sing backup vocals. And he says, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I've become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And they will proceed for 13 verses to produce a timeless song. This is arguably the most popular love song ever written. Every wedding has some reference to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Hallmark cards, there's references to this chapter. Plaques over sinks in the home, there's reference to this chapter. So travel around the world and people will have heard something related to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. This is by far the most popular love song ever written. Now, of course, it's not the only love song written. There's lots of love songs out there, and arguably most songs that have ever been produced have been love songs. And as we know, love songs divide into two categories. The first category is the Love is Really Awesome songs, you know those songs. And the other category is Love is Really Awful songs. And you will often hear those songs back to back on your radio. Would encourage you when you leave, when you make your way to Roosters, I know that's where we all gravitate to, after the service, turn on that pop station and you will hear a Love is Awesome song, only to be followed by a Love is Awful song. You will hear enchanted men and women singing, I will always love you, endless love, the power of love, all we need is love. And everyone's favorite, yummy, 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 I got love in my tummy. That's creepy, but there it is. Only to be followed up by embittered men and women singing that love is a battlefield. Love will tear us apart. Love hurts. Love stinks. I think we're confused about love, aren't we? Can you imagine some alien species listening to our radio trying to figure out what we believe and what this thing love is? Here we have endless love and love will tear us apart. That sounds like endless tearing. I'm not sure if I want to be in love. We're confused about love. And you know what? With the Corinthians, they are terribly confused and divided about this topic. And that has led to drama in the church, contention with one another, especially in the area of their God-given gifts and abilities. We saw in chapter 12 that Paul kicks off that chapter, he opens it up, and he essentially tells the Corinthians that they're acting really, really done with their God-given gifts and abilities and resources. We discover that people with flashy gifts, they looked more spectacular. They were displaying those gifts like a peacock displays its feathers strutting around, showing off to passers-by and prospective mates and rivals, strutting around thinking, look at my spiritual gifts. Aren't I something? You don't have those gifts. Aren't you nothing? And those people who are perceived to be nothing, they look up with envy, and both groups are looking at each other, and they are making the terrible misstep of viewing their gifts as an individual enterprise as opposed to something that God has given for one another, given for the good of the church, and given for the cause of Jesus Christ. And guess what? We're just like them, aren't we? We are. We all have abilities. We have gifts. We're born with them. We're born again with them as well. We don't all have the same gifts. We saw that last week with the metaphor of the body that Paul provides in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Some gifts are more out front like the eyeball. Other gifts are kind of behind the scenes like the toes in the shoes. And given the gifts here, a diversity of them in this congregation, in this church, it's easy for us to look on with suspicion about the gifts that we have, the opportunities that were afforded to us, the path that we were able to walk on that other people weren't able to walk on, or they were to walk on and we couldn't walk on, the successes that we have enjoyed that other people haven't, or that we haven't enjoyed and other people have. It's easy to look at each other's paths and with envy or with arrogance make the gifts about us, our resources about us rather than each other, the common good, the good of the church, and the cause of Christ. The Corinthians were doing this in spades. And it didn't help that the Corinthians were fiercely individualistic. And they were, man. It was all about, you know, it's me and Jesus. You get out of the way. Me and Jesus. I got to find my particular path, fulfill my destiny, maximize my potential. And as long as you don't invade my space, we're good. But if you start to slow me down, cramp my style, get in my way, then we're going to have a problem. It was about their individual path. And they thought that other people caused them to waste their opportunities, waste their gifts, waste their resources, waste their life. And again, aren't they just like us? Americans, we are so individualistic. Me and Jesus, get out of the way. Me and Jesus, and I'll like you as long as you don't impede my progress. They are just like us. We are just like them. I feel challenged by difficult people. I feel that they are inhibiting my progress. They are stifling God's plan for my life. And so for me, my gifts, my abilities, my resources, it's about me developing them in the context of my personal relationship with Jesus, seizing as many opportunities as I possibly can get. And if you get in the way, you're in trouble. Therein lies the clash. That's where we see love and gifts clashing in our passage. It's the tension that we all face, right, when we have to make that decision of, do we forego that agenda? Do we allow our progress to be slowed by that difficult person? We all have that difficult person, right? And if you don't, you are that difficult person. It's wrestling with the overwhelming sense that when God says love your neighbor as yourself, love your neighbor with your resources, your time, your talent, and your treasure, it's that little demonic voice that says that is a recipe for wasting your life. Like the Corinthians, we're not so much anti-love. They weren't anti-love. Yeah, love is good as long as it takes a backseat behind spiritual gifts in my personal agenda. Yeah, we'll at the very most upgrade it to one of many spiritual gifts that you may have, but I don't have. The Corinthians were adamant about separating the two. So much so that according to Wikipedia, the place where I get all of my sermon material, the Corinthians designed a song. They wrote a song that was later picked up and popularized by Tina Turner about their gifts, their resources, their abilities, their opportunities. This is what they were singing during their worship service. They were singing, "What's love got to do with it?" Hey, love's great, but love has nothing to do with what I have. And when it gets in the way, we're chucking love. What's love got to do with it? And there they were, waving their hands in the church service, singing that song with the spunk of Tina Turner herself. And so Paul, he picks up his guitar, he checks the mic, he clears his throat. Quill and Priscilla, they get ready, and he begins to sing, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. And if I give away all that I have and deliver up my very body to be burned for some cause and have not love, it profits me nothing. The Corinthians were singing, what's love got to do with it? Paul comes in, he says, I'll tell you what love has to do with your gifts, your abilities, your resources, your time, your talent, and treasure. It has everything to do with those things. Love makes those things count. Without love, those things become nothing, or worse than nothing, they become a detriment to you. Love makes them count. Love is not one gift to be counted among many other gifts. No, it is the very oxygen and habitat in which gifts get their particular life and their direction and their meaning. Gifts depend on love. Love is the boss. Gifts are the employees. The gifts don't boss love around. Hey, I can do this, or I'm not going to do what you say here. No, love calls the shots. Love tells the gifts what to do and when to do them. Or using the analogy suggested by the Apostle Paul, gifts are made to serve the boss of love, just like musical instruments are designed to serve music. And what happens when a musical instrument exalts itself above music? I don't need you, music. I'm an instrument. What happens? Well, some of you will say rap music. I did not say that. You said that. You thought that, I could tell. Noise happens. Discord happens. Clanging cymbals and resounding gongs happen. I'm a percussionist. And can you imagine me getting up here with my cymbals and doing a cymbal solo? Okay, watch this guy. For 15 minutes, just cranking the cymbals together. How would that edify this body? How would that encourage you? It wouldn't. It would be a detriment to your ears and your heart. Well, you know, we discover in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, we find something like cymbal solos taking place in Corinth. We see instruments being bossy with music. We discover tongue fights. In other words, people competing against one another. Someone gets up, he says, I have a tongue, and they start giving a tongue, and someone interrupts. How dare you give a tongue? I have a better tongue. And so they say it louder and more dramatic, only to be followed up by prophecy showdown. Someone saying, I'm really sensing God is saying this, and they're like, ha, 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 that's nothing compared to what God showed me last night in my dreams. Again, we discover fights about who has the greatest faith. Someone says, this week I really believe God for that thing. Someone comes along and says, that's nothing. That's nothing compared to what I believed God this week. I believe God to remove mountains. You're believing God for molehills? Clanging cymbals, noise, dissonance, chaos. Gifts were primary, love took a back seat. So they're singing, what's love got to do with it? And Paul says, I'll tell you what love got to do with it. Without love, your prophecy, your preaching, your teaching, your benevolence, feeding the poor, following some particular cause and giving your life for it means absolutely nothing. Clanging cymbals, resounding gong. And this would have been, I think, particularly stinging for the Corinthians, because what we know about that culture in Greece, you know the pagan temples, the pagan churches, do you know how they started their worship service? By clanging cymbals, by resounding the gong. This was their way of saying, hey, God, you're asleep right now. We're asking for you to visit us. So it was a way to get the God's attention, and it was a way to arouse the sleeping parishioner into action. I think we need gong sometimes during our service. This was common in cultic practice. Paul is saying, without love and the way you're acting, you might as well join a Scientology praise band and tour with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. It's that bad. It's that bad. And this, again, was stinging because the Corinthians, they thought, hey, we broke away from our pagan past. 1 Corinthians 8, we're so far from our former paganism, we can eat food sacrificed to idols in the idol's temple. We have nothing to do with our former association with false religion. And yet Paul says love is so important. Without it, you're acting like pagans. What's love got to do with it? Everything. You can have not only prophecy, you can be a super prophet and understand all mysteries and knowledge. You can have not just faith, but the most faith that anyone has ever had, moving the Cascade Mountain Range. And yet, if you don't have love, Paul says you're nothing. You can have the most dynamic gifts ever and yet amount to a big fat zero. That's how important love is. Now, part of what Paul's doing is something that we've seen him do before. Paul teaches us that our talents, our abilities, our lot in life, spiritual gifts, natural gifts, and the sum total of them are poor indicators of our spiritual status. Your gifts, all of these things are poor indicators of the condition of your heart and the status of your character. To try to assess the condition of your heart with your gifts is like trying to assess the condition of a car's engine by playing the car radio. When I was a little boy, probably 7 or 8, my dad went out and bought the coolest station wagon that didn't run. But it was awesome. And he got it for cheap. He could work on cars. He was a great mechanic. And I remember this particular station wagon. It was huge. Massive, and it was sticking out of the garage, and my dad's working on it. It's like springtime, and I remember just crawling in and out of this station wagon. So many seats. The upholstery was pristine. My dad's blaring the radio, and that radio is working so good, man. It's surround sound before there was surround sound. You can hear the music out in the street. I remember the song. It's always associated in my mind with that station wagon, and with my dad working on it, it's the song, She's Got Betty Davis. Eyes. Remember that song? Every time you hear that song, I get in a time capsule and I go back and I'm hanging out, crawling around that station wagon. And I thought, you know what? This interior is so cool. The exterior, the radio works so good. This car will be an easy fix. Gotta be, given what it looks like on the outside. And I think my dad thought that too. Because as it turned out, that station wagon became the biggest and most expensive radio we ever purchased. The radio was a poor indicator of the condition of the engine. The engine never worked. Well, the Corinthians have high-quality surround sound prophecy blaring in their midst. They have Bose quality tongues of men and angels resounding in their gathering. They have spectacular displays that would eclipse Broadway productions. They have faith to move mountains. They're getting things done. They're cranking out ministry. But the engine isn't turning over. They are missing what matters the most. How bad was it? Well, we read about it, I think, implicitly in verses 4-6. It was so bad that Paul says, you guys are impatient and unkind. You guys brag and boast. All of these terms you can trace back to other places that Paul addresses this particular church. He just brings that up, says, this is who you aren't. This is who you need to be. Corinthians, you are arrogant. You put yourself in front of other people. You are irritable. You are rude. You are brash. You are crass. You won't bear up with anything. You won't believe anything. It's all about you. You see, they were exhibit A of a hot mess of a church. Now we read about them and we're like, well, that's not us. Well, let's stop there. It may not be so obvious with us, but you know, the Bible would teach us that we can live life a certain way externally that doesn't reflect the condition of our heart. We can live in such a way that we can mask our motives. We can live good, decent lives and miss what makes decent life good. We better than the Corinthians. We the better prepared for our wife. Be the best mother. We could be the best grandmother. Anyone could have the best neighbor, the best employer. We could be the most wonderful philanthropist in the community. We can be some good thing on the outside, and that makes what makes those things something rather than nothing. And missing quality could be love. You see, good as ever you may, without love, and I'm two things. A husband who loves his wife only because he likes to be known as a good husband who loves his wife is not a good husband who loves his wife. I know I sound like Dr. Seuss again. In other words, in that case, what he really loves is not his wife. He's treating his wife good, not because he loves her, but because he loves himself. It's about him. He has abused the gift of marriage. The Corinthians are abusing the spiritual gifts that they have. We tend to abuse the many blessings and gifts that God gives us. They were saying, what's love got to do with it? And Paul says, I'll tell you what love got to do with it. Love has everything to do with your life. Now, what Paul then does in verses 8 through 13 is he turns the tables around. And he creates his own little melody. It's a response to this particular song, later popularized by Tina Turner. They're singing what's love got to do with it, all to demean the role and status of love. And Paul now begins to sing, okay, I got a lyric for you. What's gifts got to do with it? All to downgrade the role of gifts that have been super exaggerated in their mind. How does Paul do that? Notice verse 8. As for prophecies, they will last forever and ever. Nope. They're going to pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away, for we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. What's gifts got to do with it? Paul says, I'll tell you about your gifts. I'll tell you about your abilities and resources that you are so obsessing over. Let me tell you, Paul says, that they are trendy. Gifts are trendy. Like the Spice Girls in the 90s, they are here today and gone tomorrow. And for those of you who have never heard of the Spice Girls, that's my point. They are trendy. As for prophecies, they're going to pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will be done away. The partial, these things are trendy, but is love abide forever? And to the degree that my gift is utilizing love, expressing love for my producer, ladder, I'm not taking my gift with me, heaven. If I could have my gift, not right with when I take that, and I'll just not have the only thing that you're going to take with you, I'll just inverse them for God's love, birth, and in your heart, hearts, or people. Don't use what has given you resources, your time, your talent, and your treasures, and see those things else, people. That's what makes it happen. You see, gifts are trendy, but people aren't. People will remain forever. People are invaluable in God's eyes. Because it's all about people, all about your neighbor, all about their well-being. Would you make your life about loving your neighbor and not express your gift? All about people. So in occasion for him, we'll have this chapter next week in the following week. Paul says, therefore, pursue love. The first, pursue love. Pursue people. Once you got down, then on the back end of that, you can earn a desire spreading your spokes. Especially the gift says that of the greatest bang, the above serving people. Make it about love, he says. What's gifts got to do with it? Well, they're trendy. And also, Paul says they are for children. Check that out. Verse 11. When I was a child, I spoke, thought, reasoned as a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. The idea is here. On this side of the grave, on this side of glory, we are little kids. We're little children on little bikes with training wheels. When we grow up, That's when we meet Jesus, that's when we grow up. Spiritual gifts are like training wheels in this life, Paul argues. And I'll tell you about training wheels. My children were convinced that they had mastered the art of bike riding because they didn't fall because their training wheels were on. And there they were, you know, just as awkward as can be, and they thought, I have mastered the art of riding a bike. They thought that they had arrived, when in reality, the presence of the training wheels was an indictment upon their bike riding abilities. It was a declaration that they were horrible at bike riding. And it was only after they grew up and shed those wheels and started to ride on their own that they felt a bit embarrassed about the training wheels. Yeah, the Corinthians are. They got prophecy and tongues and the working of miracles. And they're like, look at me. I have arrived. Aren't I something special? And Paul says, this is a testimony that you're a little kid. The Corinthians, when they think of what they have, they view themselves in their mind like this guy. That's them, you know. When in reality, Paul says, you're not that guy. You're that little guy. The fact that spiritual gifts are in operation is clear proof that we haven't arrived. The fact that there is prophecy is an indication that we don't know as we ought to know. The fact that we have all the gifts listed for us, present and available to us, tells us that we only get faint glimpses of eternal glory, and that we're not even remotely where we need to be, and that we need to work on more substantive eternal things like love, relationships, and self-sacrifice. You see, they got gifts and love all mixed up. And that leads to a huge point that I think Paul makes implicitly, that they were missing about the comparison of these two things, gifts and love, and we tend to. And here's the dramatic reality. I think the Bible would teach us this. The work of God to change a selfless sinner like you and I, self-absorbed people like you and I who want to make everything about ourselves, and if anyone gets in the way, well, we banish them from our emotional, physical life. That act by which God changes selfish sinners into selfless lovers of other people, taking their own resources, time, talent, treasure, gifts, and using them to better other people, that action of God changing or transforming a person is the far greater miracle than someone speaking in the tongues of men and of angels. They're not even in the same ballpark. Do you realize that you can have spiritual gifts and not even be a believer? Judas, not born again. Judas sent out with the 12. Judas exercising demons, healing people. Balaam, false prophet, given words from God that he delivers. Jesus says, many will come to me in that day, and they will say, did we not prophesy in your name? Cast out demons in your name. Do mighty feats in your name. And Jesus says, depart from me. I never knew you. Gifts mean nothing without the transforming work of grace in our hearts. What's gifts got to do with it? Paul says, gifts compared to love, they're nothing. Love is the ultimate charismata, the ultimate miraculous gift birthed in the heart by which people take what they have and they selflessly use those things to serve other people. Now, that does bring up the question, what is love? Paul answers that question in verses 4 through 6, and the answer that he gives turns out to be all about people who slow us down, invade our space, cramp our style, slow us from reaching our potential so as we think it to be. It's about challenging our notions of self-love. It runs in direct opposition to what we feel naturally and what the Corinthians were exhibiting in their congregation. Paul says, I'll tell you about the nature of love. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love takes a lot. Love gives a lot. This presumes difficult people. You're not patient with people who are always on time, who meet all of your expectations. No, you're patient with people who aren't. The King James Version says love is long-suffering. It suffers along with insufferable people. Remember hearing the story of the guy who was trapped in traffic, his car stalled out, he couldn't start his car, the light turned green, and everyone behind him started honking their horn. He's trying to start the car, it's not turning over, everyone's honking their horn, it's not causing the engine to work. Finally, flustered, he gets out of his car, he goes to the first car that was honking their horn, he says to the guy driving, "Sir, I can't seem to start my engine. Would you do me a favor? Would you go up and try to start my car, and I'll stay back here and honk your horn for you?" How quick are you to honk your horn? Are you pounding on the horn when people have stalled out in front of you? They're getting in your way. They're slowing you down. What we discover here, love is patient. And it's kind. Not only does it endure, it gives to people it endures. It is open-handed. It is gracious. It's not just mercy, which is I'm not going to give you what you deserve, which is something bad. It's gracious. I'm going to give you what you don't deserve, which is something good. Love does not envy. Envy is that painful, resentful feeling that we have when people have an advantage that we think we ought to have and they shouldn't have. Why did they grow up in that home? How were they able to land that job? Why do they have those gifts? That's not fair. They're not deserving of that. I am. And so envy, the root word means an inner seething, an inner boiling that comes out, I think, in passive, aggressive, subtle forms of manipulation and of harm. Paul says love does not envy. It says, you know what? They enjoy what seems to be a greater lot in life. That's all grace. Everything's all grace. Everything in life is grace. Where I am at is grace. It's all about the grace of God. Love does not envy, nor does it boast. Boasting is almost the exact opposite of envy. Envy looks up and says, you shouldn't have that. Boasting looks down at someone's plight and says, you deserve that. I deserve where I am at. Boasting literally means you're a windbag. Right, you're just bellowing out how you're so special and other people aren't. Love does not boast, is not arrogant. It is not rude, Paul says. It's not insensitive. Love can be brutally honest without the brutality. Comes along and speaks truth tactfully. Paul says love does not insist on its own way. 10:24, let no one seek his own good, the good of his neighbor. That's love. It's not insensitive to people, nor is it oversensitive to people. It is not irritable, Paul says. We've all heard of IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. I sometimes suffer from IPS, irritable personality syndrome. And it's usually with my family. Paul says love doesn't have IPS. Love is not irritable. Love is not resentful. It keeps no records of wrong. It doesn't hold a grudge. Like the story of a couple married for 60 years. When they got married, the lady, she had a box, and she hid the contents of that box and told her husband, I don't want you ever looking in that box. She put it in her closet, and periodically she would secretly put things in that box and take things out of that box. And that husband was faithful not to look or peer into the box to see the contents thereof. 60 years later, she gets terribly sick. She thinks she's going to pass away. And so she asks her husband to retrieve the box. He does. She reveals the contents of the box to her husband, and there in the box are two crocheted dolls and a wad of money amounting to about $100,000. He's puzzled. He says, what in the world are these items for? She proceeds to tell the story that right before they got married, her grandma said that the secret to a wonderful marriage was not to hold a grudge, not to stay angry overnight. And if she would ever feel tempted to do that, what she had to do was to simply crochet a doll and get over it. And the husband heard that story, and he was just overwhelmed with joy because he saw only two dolls in the box, and he thought, I've only made my wife mad for 60 years two times. So he's just celebrating, and then he says, well, what about the wad of cash? And she says, oh, yeah, that's all the money that I made selling the other dolls. Love converts relational debts into relational assets. He says, love does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. And as we know, we live in a culture that says the most loving thing to do is to celebrate and affirm one's lifestyle, no matter if you are disobeying God and are headed to hell. We are told that if we do that, if we challenge people, if we try to bring them away from their lifestyle, their choices, that that's the most hateful thing that we can possibly do. We live in a country that calls black, white, and white, black, wrong, right, and right, wrong. And Paul says, be countercultural, do love God's way. Love says this, you're in a burning building, get out of it. That's what love does. Love will try to pull you out of that burning building, risking life and limb. Love sees the choices of people and the destruction thereof for time and eternity and tries to intervene. That's the most loving thing to do. The less loving thing to do is to say, I'm not going to be bothered about your choices. I'm not going to be made to feel uncomfortable about challenging you with your choices. You see, love does not rejoice in wrongdoing. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Now, there's a lot more to be said about these attributes of love, but let me tell you this. I can just hear and see the Corinthians recoiling from this description, their eyes rolling, them saying, Paul, if we do what you tell us we ought to do, you have made us a doormat for other people. You're going to make us waste our life, squander our potential. You're going to detour us from God's path for our individual relationship with Him. This is a recipe for wasting one's life. And you know what? I tell myself that. As I face the temptation, often with difficult people, to not believe what God says in the second great commandment, to love my neighbor just like myself, to love my neighbor selflessly, to love my neighbor with kindness and patience and with self-control, bearing all things, enduring all things, hoping all things. And in the back of my mind, the devil says, my flesh says, God is a liar here. This is a recipe for ruin. All the time missing the obvious. All the time, as the Corinthians were doing, missing the obvious. And here's the obvious. As great as the question is, what is love? And that's a good question. There's a better question to ask. And that question is this. Who is love? Love is not so much a what as it is a who. And I want to submit to you, verses 4 through 6 is a description of God's love. It's a description of Jesus' love. Jesus is patient and kind with people who are intolerable. Jesus is being patient and kind with these corrupt Corinthians. Jesus is patient and kind, does not envy, does not boast, is not irritable, is bearing all things with you and I. Jesus bore all things. He endured all things on the cross for you and I. Jesus is the embodiment of love, and we are the beneficiaries of love. What if Jesus treated us the way we treat other people, the way that the Corinthians were treating one another? The good news of the gospel is that Jesus bears all things and endures all things by his grace and for our good. He takes our place on the cross when he didn't have to and we were in his way. He takes our place on the cross when we maligned him. He deals kindly with eternally intolerable people, doing the ultimate, sacrificing his very life. Let me put it to you differently in the context of spiritual gifts. Jesus takes his abilities, his powers, you might say his gifts, and he causes them to serve the cause of his love for us, for our good, for our redemption. He uses these powers and abilities to lavish infinite grace upon the infinitely ill-deserving. And notice, when he does that, he doesn't think it's a waste. He doesn't think that his blood spilled from the cross is a waste. He doesn't say, you know what? I've really departed from God's plan for my life. I've really derailed the plan of being the Messiah. I really haven't maximized the will of God for my life. No, as it turns out, him bearing with our sins, with our failures, using all of his resources, all of his gifts, all of his abilities to save us, turns out to be the joy that was set before him. Like everything in life, this turns out to be a gospel issue. You see, the gospel says that at the very heart of your condition, you have to admit that you can't. The gospel says you fall short of the glory of God. Without Jesus, you are utterly undone. That all of your abilities, resources, time, talent, and treasure, they're squat compared to the infinite gulf that you have to traverse because of your sin. And this means that we have to look to the ability of another, the gifting, you might say, of another, the accomplishments of another. We look away from ourselves and what we can do, and we look to Jesus who has done it, who in turn lavishes upon us gifts to boot. And once we get the gospel front and center once again, that absolutely transforms how we view what we have, the gifts that we possess, the resources that are ours. Because what we discover here is, I can't use these to prop up my pride, to prop up my value, to be an indicator of how people ought to approve of me. Because there's only one person whose approval counts, and that is God. And he has given me the divine approval. He has said, not guilty, and declared righteous. And so I don't need to use my gifts to try to say, look at me. I point to Jesus, who says of me, says of us, you are my beloved sons and daughters, and I rest in that. And so now I take these gifts and I say, I don't have to use them as a project of self-salvation. So how can I use them? Oh, maybe I should use them the way that Jesus used his powers and abilities. He used them to serve people for their good. And now I can see my gifts and I can say, how can I use these selflessly? The way that Jesus used his gifts, his abilities, selflessly to serve people. Because therein lies the fulfillment of our gifts, serving other people. Shelton First Baptist Church, I'm going to keep encouraging you next 2 weeks, and I'm going to say it right now, earnestly desire spiritual gifts. That's a really good thing. But make your primary project in life love. It's better to be giftless than loveless. It's better to be giftless and have love. You'll have more impact on people, more transformative impact on people than if you had no love and had all the gifts listed in our passage. Major on love. Loving people. Make it about people. Pursue love. Pursue people. Make it about your neighbor. Make it about their good. And therein you will find your niche in God's kingdom. You'll just fall right into it. And you will experience a joy inexpressible and full of glory. Do what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10:24. Let no one seek his or her own good, but the good of his neighbor. Let's pray. God, I know this about my heart. I just naturally gravitate to making my gifts about my individual path with you. And I think that's all of our hearts. That's our fallen instinct. And so, God, we come to you and we say, hey, this is where we're at. God, would you change our hearts? Would you make it more loving? Would you apply the benefits of the new covenant, making our hearts more and more lovers of God and lovers of other people? God, would you challenge our bad motives in whatever enterprise that we are in right now? And would you transform those motives to be motives that desire to bless others rather than to be blessed? God, once again, we want to see the gospel front and center. We want to see Jesus using all of the resources of heaven, laying aside everything, becoming a man to take rebels and sinners and corrupt people so as to turn them into sons and daughters of God. God, may we see our abilities as mere extensions and displays and pointers to how you use your abilities. God, we thank you for the love of God. We thank you for the love of the Father. We thank you for the love of the Spirit. We thank you, Triune God, for the love that pours out of your communion into a dark, dying world and brings new creation. God, may we be struck again with awe at the grandeur of your love, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.